Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host, teacher, and socialist Andy Lipson. We're online at what-s-left.webno.com. Our co-host, socialist and community organizer Kenny Cepeda, is on a much-needed break today and will rejoin us next week. Kenny, if you're listening, saludos. But what's exciting today is that we'll be in conversation with two special guests, Steven Santos Rico and Tracy Burt, to discuss developmental psychology, mental health, and the pros of online learning. If folks have been following us regularly, wherever you get these episodes, you will have noticed that we've been on a sort of train of a series of episodes on this ongoing topic we've been covering on What's Left, going by several different names, which are personalized learning, distance online learning, asynchronous or synchronous learning, digital learning, remote or blended learning. They're all loosely defined terms that are largely synonymous with education technology. And we've been having folks speak about it. We've had reflections here on it with Andy and AJ, including with Kenny, just the three of us. Andy Lipson and AJ talked about what should be the working class response to all of these changes that are coming, specifically in education. And Alison McDowell, who we had on What's Left, talked about the implementation of the fourth industrial revolution in the context of this pandemia, of data-driven tech used for virtual classrooms pushed by strong corporate interests. John Kleizek, who we spoke with, talked about the specific government and corporate agendas that are looking to dismantle public education, and that in mind, students and educators with a long-term plan to replace teachers with AI and strip away completely the human social context. Something we're going to do differently is today we are going to turn to Tracy and Steven to discuss what this will do to our kids on a more personal level, on the more human side of things. Mentally, socially, emotionally, and I'm really, really excited to have this conversation with Tracy and Steven. Thank you both for being here. Really, really, really glad you both are here.
Yeah.
Yes. I want to really introduce Steven and Tracy because they've been working on this for a very long time. Steven has been working with children and families in San Francisco Bay Area since 1972 and retired from City College of San Francisco in 2015 from the Child Development and Family Studies Department. In the last 35 years, he has focused his work on children with sensory processing challenges and neurological development of young children. He has spoken about the impact of stress and its impacts on the children's neurological, social, / emotional, and physical development. Tracy has been working with children and families for over 30 years as a teacher, counselor, and advocate. Her focus has been on individual and community healing from trauma and the impact of stress, trauma, and inequities, particularly when working in the field of domestic violence prevention. She has taught in the Child Development and Family Studies Department at CCSF for 16 years. Welcome, Tracy and Siren. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you, Eduardo.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It's really nice to be here.
It's like I'm in awe just having these two special people for me, for them to be here. I'm just sort of just very, very excited and happy for you to be here with us and joining us in this conversation. So Steven and Tracy, maybe we can just start with the basics. If you can just share with us the little bit, some background of the nuances of like who you are and your backgrounds.
Well, I can go first. I'm a mom, I'm a teacher, and I'm a writer, and those are all three vocations that I have. And I feel just really honored to be just to be here and to be engaged in this work and to have work that I get paid for in the world, as well as other work that's meaningful to me and that I can really contribute, hopefully, to the world. What I try to center in all of my work is an active process of debiasing and taking action for social and racial justice. And part of why I can be here today is because I was able to have a sabbatical for a year looking at the impact of technology on children and on children's brains and their their bodies and minds and families. And so I was able to do a lot of reading and research. And that's because my union advocated for that and protects that right. And so I want to acknowledge that that's part of why I have been able to really deepen my expertise and in this area. So, yeah.
So I grew up in the Bay Area in the 50s and 60s. And so my experience around my childhood was really one of just being very free to have choices and do things that I wanted to do with my friends in a very unencumbered way. And so, you know, the world, of course, is a very different place, but my childhood experiences were really kind of grounded in this. We did become involved in the anti-war movement. My mother was an activist. That was part of my life. I ran into people, you know, 30 years later, and we would, you know, talk about our kind of shared experiences growing up and being involved in political action, because that was really for us the core of who we are. And then my child development life began fairly early. I've worked in many, many different places, which has been a really fortunate thing. I used to do things every 2 years, but I worked in San Francisco. I started a program in Sunnydale. I worked in the Bayview. I worked in the Mission. I worked with different age children, starting from preschool, and I did young school age. And then I went to the college, and I opened several programs at City College of San Francisco. And in my journey and discovering what was really important to me about young children and their development was really through one of my mentors who I worked with for 40 years, who really just kind of got me reading and discussing and arguing and about how children's brains develop, how it's important to have sensory experiences. And then all of that informed the programs that we actually developed. So our programs were very specific in that child choice, child-directed play was the basis of the program. And we spent a lot of time talking about that to parents so they understood what was happening. And sometimes I see them 35 years later and they still talk about it, how wonderful it was for them and their children to be in a place that was very nurturing and very connected people together to support each other. So, I did a lot of parent co-op work, and I believe in that model. I think it's a strong model, and I think we should really encourage that, encourage parents to come together, become active, become activists for their children's schools. And that's what really was the consequence of the parents being in co-ops, I thought.
I just want to do a quick shout out to Nina Mogar, who is a mentor for Eduardo, Stephen, and I, and she's the person who brought us together. We actually met at her memorial, or re-met, I should say, and we've been working together to try to find ways to extend her legacy, and so she's with us right now, and yes, she would be happy that we're having this conversation.
Yeah.
And as a public school teacher, I'm really glad to have you both here. We're about to start 100% distance learning in San Francisco Unified, actually largely around California, most of the major school districts, at the least for sure at the high school, middle school level, and likely at the elementary level, are all going to see some form of just 100% distance learning, Zoom classes, synchronous learning, some asynchronous, whatever. And largely on the basis of what is described as for the safety of teachers and for the safety of our students and children. I guess what I'm hope to hear about is a larger context of what do you make of this experience that we're all about to go through of distance learning and all online learning as it relates to the question of safety and education. I definitely want to hear about that, because it was a horrible experience doing it, very alienating, doing it in April and May. I'd like to know what y'all know about more than just that, about what this is going to mean for us.
I think a good place to start is to just really kind of focus in on the child and what we know about how children's brains, bodies, and minds develop, and what they need to optimally develop. And we know that they need connection with real people who care about them, who respond to them. They need to know that they're loved. They need to know that they're honored as humans, in a real environment. They need touch to organize their brains and their nervous systems, particularly the younger they are, the more they need that. They need, which means that social distancing is not going to work for them, right? They need three-dimensional sensory experiences where they're using all their senses, including their physical senses, their vestibular and proprioceptive senses of movement and sensory integration. They need these sensory integration experiences. They need movement, and they need experiences that organize their nervous systems. So we know that there are hundreds of books and thousands of studies about why children need these things to optimally develop. And it's not a question. I think the question is, when we insert tech into that, any kind of tech or screen into that dynamic of children's dynamic development, what happens? Is it interrupting relationships or supporting relationships? Is it taking away sensory experiences or adding to them? And, you know, what's going to happen is we're going to have to live in this gray space and look at how we can use tech as a tool, because in my opinion right now, most of us, I mean, in terms of our society and the way we think about tech, we're letting tech determine us. And I don't want to let tech determine me. I want to decide how I'm going to use it and be conscious about how I'm using tech. And it's really hard for me to do that because it feels like it's just necessary. And the truth is some tech is necessary. And I don't judge anybody for using technology. I mean, there's so many things that are attractive about technology, and it seems like it's going to solve all these problems. And it's constructed, if we pan back out, it's constructed as if it's going to solve these problems for us. It's going to give us some frictionless experiences, why we think it's good to have frictionless experiences learning is, I mean, that doesn't really hold up to the research, right? So for me, it's about asking these questions. So starting with the kids is where I want to start. Let's see, let me start again. So I want to both start with the kids and then come back and keep asking these questions. I think it's more about us asking questions about it and figuring out how to be in this gray area of how we use tech and not let it use us. Stephen, what do you think about the...
Well, I think about it in kind of from a developmentalist perspective, which is to say 80% of children's brains are sensory lobes. And if they're not engaged in real world experiences, manipulating things, tearing them apart, building them back together again, feeling materials, gauging the differences, all those things are part of what we used to have in what we would call a play environment. You know, even not necessarily a large group of children, but children in some way interacting with each other to construct their own reality, to construct their own ideas, to represent their ideas through their play. And so my fear is that there's going to be a period of time, which we don't know about at this point, where there's going to be a group of children who are not going to be having consistent, regular experiences around this kind of play. The consequence of that, in my opinion, is that there's going to be perhaps a lack of development based on the idea that they're not getting nurtured in that particular way. The other part of it to me, which I think is really critical, is that the social interaction that one has in real time with someone, even one other person, for young children really helps them to determine what's happening in that relationship by picking up on facial cues, by picking up on the tone of voice, and all of those things that naturally occur in relationships are not going to be present for them for the most part. It will happen through a screen, but I don't know and I don't believe that it at all represents the kind of experiences that young children need. And so I understand the push out that people are engaged in right now, but we have to be really, really, really mindful and creative around what will that virtual classroom look like other than them looking at a screen. And then it becomes incumbent upon people who are responsible for that, who actually need to be supported, I believe, a lot, and how to reconstruct that and revision that so it has parts of what children need on some kind of consistent basis. And I think, and we can talk about it later, but there are ways that we can make this less stressful for children. For some children, it's going to be continuing traumatic, which is going to have consequences. So I think there's a way that we can accomplish it, but we have to be intentional and we have to be clear about what we're doing and we have to ask a lot of questions and also demand answers to those. So that's my feeling about all of that at this point.
And could I ask this question? So I think the San Francisco School District might have an quote answer for that, in that at the elementary school level, there is going to be screen time, but they're also outsourcing their physical time together where they don't have them meet at a school, but they are going to go to different community centers, SF MoMA and things like that. So that is there is that discussion. And I think that's part of the plan for anybody who's up to sixth grade. At middle school and high school, it's screens. I mean, that's just what it's going to be for this semester. So can you tell me about what that, like, there, it sounds like they're thinking, oh yeah, we know about that. That's the young kids. We're going to give them part-time screen, but middle school, high school, full-time screen. When you're talking about this development, is this something, could you tell me what that means? Like, when does that development end and what are they getting wrong about that?
So I think one of the main problems that could occur with this whole idea is there's still not a lot of evidence around whether or not they can use screen time and translate that information and remember it in a meaningful way. The other part of it is that I think that for that particular age group, we have teens in our family, so we're going through this and have been going through this for months now, is that there's shutdown and resistance to the methodology. And so when you're not engaged in some active way, it doesn't matter if you're 3 or if you're 16 or you're 17 or 18 or college age. If you don't have any investment in what's happening and you're at the effect of it, then the brain basically is not as engaged and can turn off to the experience. So the question is, how much learning is really going on in this particular context? You know, are we accomplishing the goals that are being set when it's almost like here's the screen and we're inputting information into you, but is there a reciprocal kind of relationship going on where their ideas are heard, responded to? And that's what I've been hearing from the teens that I've been talking to, is that they just are not looking forward to this happening again. And so when we have all these learning outcomes and plans and everything, they're supposed to reach and goals and all of that. But have we really thought that through in a way that they're actively involved to the extent that their brains are paying attention to it? And I haven't gone into the social emotional part of it, but just as a learning experience, you know, is that really happening for a number of young people? And if we look at the information that we've been getting, which we don't know how true it is necessarily, 60% are maybe not going to school.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So they're not even, they haven't switched on that switch. So
they're not logging on
on.
That's all. I mean, I don't know about going to school. They're not logging on.
Yeah. They're not logging on. So of that, I mean, now we're looking at a much smaller percentage of the system not even reaching, you know, that group of young people. And so, I mean, there's just so much that is problematic for them, for their families, for the teachers, for, you know, people are trying to grapple with this. I spoke with a friend of mine in the East Bay yesterday who's developing programs, and she just said, you know, we're just kind of flying by the seat of our pants by trying to hit and miss a lot of this. And you know, people talk about it being an experiment. Well, you know, that's very tricky. That's very problematic for a lot of children who really need to have a very consistent kind of experience around, you know, what we're calling learning. And so I think that it really has to be looked at incredibly carefully from many, many standpoints. I just think it's complex, but as you know, because you're teaching now, you just don't have time for all of this to come together. You know, it's definitely a challenge.
I just want to add that, you know, not only do I really want to pan out in terms of what our new normal is now, and I don't like calling it our new normal. I would rather call it the temporary normal, because I don't want it to become our normal, right? I want it to be temporary. But before that, what was our new normal in terms of ed tech and tech in schools? There is little to no evidence that ed tech tools help children's learning. There's a theory that they could help differentiate children's learning and give children, based on their skill level or understanding level, give them different kinds of tasks that could meet them where they are. But in actuality, the studies don't back up that that's what's happening with the kids. So even though it theoretically could be used for that, it's not being used for that. You know, there's an exception. There's been small gains shown in some math programs, but I have, you know, overall, when you look at the actual studies, this is not an evidence-based practice using tech in education. And we are always supposed to be, as educators, using evidence-based practices, but somehow the technology got a huge pass. And that's a whole other question about how that happened. But it's important to think about that and to ask questions, all larger questions also, I think, about who's benefiting. You know, gaming companies, video gaming companies are doing really well right now. Kids, they're showing, it was in March or April, a survey said that kids were using screens 50% more than when they were before. And we know that their average screen use is 7 hours a day. So that puts them around 10 or 11 hours a day, which is probably more than they're sleeping. And that's another piece around children's basic health. Does tech, we know that sleep is important. We know that high quality sleep is important for us to all throughout the lifespan, but especially for children, they need long periods of time. They should be sleeping often for 10 or 12 hours when they're little. And even my son is 10, he still should be sleeping 10 or 11 hours a night, so that he can metabolize what he's learning and we can make those connections and they can actually deep rest. And does tech help sleep? It definitely doesn't. I mean, and it can really interrupt it depending on how we use it. It can, you know, whether it's the blue light or the timing or the activation of our nervous systems and the anxiety. And the emotional impact of this is a whole other kind of thread we could go on. And just in the kids that I know, there's so many kids that are having random rashes, and I guess adults too, from the stress. And I understand that living in a pandemic is a huge deal. It's very stressful. And it's like, how can schools help children work that through? How can we provide the consistency and the real connections that children need so that they can move through that in the best way possible? But the stress isn't only the pandemic. The stress, children name the stress as having to be in a Zoom room, as having Zoom exhaustion, as having Zoom headaches. I mean, there's actually a name for it. So that's no small thing.
I think a lot of people, and I actually thought it might look this way, but here's what it's really going to look like for these kids at the level of high school. I teach high school. And it's going to be my class, and then a second period class, and a third period class, and then a fourth period class, kind of either all of them in one day, or you'll do first, second, third on Monday, on Tuesday, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh on Wednesday, and repeat, or all seven classes. But right now we all see each other here in this gallery view. But when students log on, particularly students in the most disadvantaged environments, it's 18, 25 black screens that they're looking at, because they don't want anyone to see them. They don't want anyone to see back what's behind them. It's there's some craziness going on. Everyone's muted. And we are going to spend hours doing that. Now, the alternative is, as a teacher, don't let them do that. Tell them they have to put their video on. Tell them that they have to show so we can see who they are, so we can all be community. So that's the situation we're going to be facing. It's this devil's bargain. Do you let them be, quote, more comfortable? Black screens everyone. That's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to tell them they have to do. Or do you tell them they have to see each other and then try to build community from that? Can you tell me what you think that's going to mean? Like, what does your background tell you that's going to mean for them to do that? Now, I think we're going to be doing this a lot longer, but at least for a semester. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about what that's going to mean for them to have to do that.
Well, I think there's going to be a disconnect for them. And when we think about social emotional development and social isolation and not being engaged with people and not feeling some kind of community connection with other people, children who are at risk for any number of things, the likelihood that those things are going to occur at a much higher rate are probably going to happen. So we really have a group of children whose risk factors have now probably increased significantly. And then from just hearing what you're saying, you really don't have the ability to kind of be there in some fashion for them unless they choose to be, but they're also in high school, so there's going to be resistance to that, meaning if I don't do it, you're not going to do it, we're not going to do it. So there's not going to be like a lot of options. So that to me is a very troubling thing, because we know that what I've heard from the teens that I've been talking to and the family and their friends is they feel a sense of isolation already. They can't be with their friends. They can't connect with their friends the way that they need to or want to. And for children who have more support, they can somehow negotiate or manage that. But I've also heard that there's you know, teenagers who don't have that kind of support system who have gone to their rooms and shut the door and are staying in. And that is really, really, really troubling. I mean, and so that's where I'm so concerned about that particular group who are just not feeling any kind of real connection. And if it's not happening in their immediate environment, then as we know, sometimes friends become that. Teachers and friends and other people that they can get to become a resiliency factor for them, because those people can reach out to them and they can connect with them. They did this study, I don't know, several years ago on resiliency and middle school and high schoolers. And they basically had these at-risk kids who had multiple issues going on. And if they had a mentor and they only saw the mentor 35 minutes occasionally, that experience of meeting with that person changes the trajectory for them in many significant ways. And it just blew me away, because I'm thinking, you know, there's so many people that want to be available for young people, but we've created no comprehensive system of mentoring. We have put no dollars into mentoring. We have done none of those things, but that we already know that can keep them together. Just that minimal amount of contact. They interviewed these young people and they said, I just felt that she was there for me. I felt that I could reach out to her and she would be there for me or whatever. And I just think 30 minutes over a period of time and that helps them keep it together. I mean, we just need to push that thing, you know, really, really hard, because these young people are really, really hurting in lots of different ways. And it's very, very troubling to me, for sure.
I mean, what I want to add to that is that relationships and responsive relationships are the heart of good teaching at any age, for any age student. And so there is no relationship happening if there's a black screen. And let's be real. I mean, what are students doing? If I was in that situation as an adult who knows that it's not helpful for me to do that in terms of my learning, I would be on my phone, I would be doing other things. And does that mean that I'm able, what that means is that I'm not able to learn. So we know that multitasking basically means that we're not learning very much. I mean, there's lots of studies on that, right? We're not gonna be able to retain information. It's very hard not to multitask on a webinar, in a meeting, for adults. And I don't know how we would expect teens not to multitask. I mean, if I don't even really, I mean, I have to really be very intentional about it. And that's, if I was able to go to in my social media as a teenager, I think that's what I would have been doing too, in the middle of a meeting, in the middle of a class, because that sounds much more interesting sometimes. But that it also, there's not the back and forth engagement that Stephen was talking about that the brain needs. So my personal opinion is that that's counterproductive. It's counterproductive, and that why don't we restructure it so every teacher has 15 students that they check in with one-on-one once a week, and then have small group learning? Or, I mean, I feel that we need to look at what the opportunities are during this pandemic, and we need to start fixing our schools, and maybe we can create something new. And that's also the banking model, right? I mean, how would you do anything but the banking model if you're, it would be very difficult. I mean, I suppose people can talk still, but it's going to be really difficult, because it's hard to build trust. Teens need to be able to trust their teachers, to be able to engage, and then to engage with each other. And so that puts the teachers in a really tough situation, I think. I want to share something else, is that, which has kind of been one of the disturbing things that I've learned in the last couple of weeks, is that there have been a lot of African-American parents saying that their kids, they've seen their kids, after being out of school for a while, regaining a sense of confidence in themselves. And so that is a tragic, disturbing reflection of what our school systems are doing to African-American children. And I think that we have to use this opportunity to change what needed to be changed decades ago, right? And I mean, that's really profound.
I think it's important, Tracy. You mentioned that, and in a private talk we had the three of us on Monday, and I know that for my nephew, who's five, his confidence level just at home is different from how he feels when he was, for just, what was it, and the first time he went to school in August to mid-March, was it? I forget when that wasn't the whole full school year, but it's all of the mindset, the way that the school is structured, that is sort of every man for himself. Now everyone has to sort of fight their way around. It's like the rut always will have the shorter end of the stick or whatever, right? And I think that when you're already in a disadvantaged point and you're going to a school where you do have to fight to get attention or services, you're giving up and who you are as an individual, I think. I really resonated with that. My nephew, we're not African American, but I could see how families of color definitely could sense that as well, if there was a study for it as well.
Well, public education prior in February of this year, it is a place that reinforces all the problems, and reproduces all the problems that we see in society, of racism, of sexism, of divisions, of class. It's its function. So in one sense, that's one of the reasons why they're able to get away with, like, well, this whole thing should be reimagined, because public education really, for the things that regular people want out of education, public education won't and can't work under this system. Now they are trying to make a new system, you know, they are, and using the failure of public education to say, look, now we can individualize this for you. We can collect all this data on you. So I guess I'd be curious what y'all think of that. And think of it in terms of the racism in society, and the gender oppression and nationalism, and the experience of our immigrant communities, who I saw largely, It was 50% absence of our mainstream population and 75 to 80% absence of our EL population. And in fact, our school district has already kind of begun to factor out our EL students. As a teacher at Mission High School, we're being told we're not going to be getting as many EL students this year. And no one is telling me why. And so I'd be curious what you think of this new thing that's being sold to us as a more individualized, personalized, maybe even more objective, so it won't have racism because it's data driven. What are your thoughts?
I would say that data driven, we already know that algorithms and facial recognition software have racism embedded in them because of who's making them. And not necessarily purposefully, but unless people start to think purposefully about how to not make something racist, and then it's going to be racist. It's within a racist system. The public school system was created by and for white property owning men, and it slowly, you know, sort of expanded to serve other people, but it was created to support a certain class of people. So there is a way that it's, as someone who's a big advocate of transformation in education and educational reform, it's hard to do, I don't know sometimes if it's possible to transform a system that was created for a particular purpose, even though there are, I know, probably millions of us who are, you know, working to transform it and who have in the past. I think people need to really think about, I think I need to think about what my privacy means to me and how important it is. And it's very difficult for me right now to balance what's happening in terms of the pandemic. And I believe, my personal belief is that COVID is very real and much more dangerous than like a regular flu or something like that. And I just met someone yesterday who lost her brother and two aunts in 2 weeks in El Salvador. And, to COVID. And so, and then I don't know anyone who's died, thankfully, but every person of color, every African-American person, at least that I know, and knows someone who died. So, and I have a friend who was, who's white, who was very, very sick for like a month and then had a fever she had a fever for the whole month and she's still not recovered. It's a few months later. So I really feel that it has a different impact. Well, it does have a different impact on different communities. So I think that we have to think about how to keep ourselves safe and how to reduce. I like the harm reduction approach, kind of a middle way. But how do we keep ourselves safe without cutting off our nose to spite our face? We could keep ourselves safe without having Zoom classes of 30 kids with black screens. Like, there's so many ways. We shouldn't have 20 or 30 or 40 kids in a Zoom room. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work for adults. So when we try to push down things that are sort of designed for adults onto children, we're going to see the negative impact of those things. So are people saying right now that the online education that's happening is more personalized? Or I mean, that's what it's sort of, I think it's kind of silly that they say personalized education is another name for ed tech. I was really kind of thinking about that the last couple of days since our conversation. It's depersonalized education. I mean, this is not the same as if we were in a living room talking and recording a podcast. It's going to have a different feeling. It's going to be interesting. It's valuable, but it's not the same.
Just to answer your question about are people calling it personalized, in an article I think that was shared by Stephen, I forget who shared it, but it was, yes, personalized education, as I said in the intro, is also another loosely defined term that is being used as education technology, and remote learning, blended learning, all of these terms that are there, I think, meant to confuse us all or whatever. I don't know, but yes, personalized learning is what we're being sold.
Okay.
I was listening to something, I think this past week, and I think it was SPORM, and parents were calling in to discuss kind of what's going to happen. And it struck me that, again, we're going to have a lot of stratification around resources. So a parent called in and said, well, you know, we just really we're opting out of this. We're just not going to do it. Five of us are getting together. We're hiring our own teacher. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have our own school. And so we know what that's going to look like in terms of that experience for that group of children, middle schoolers or whatever. So we're beginning to move in that kind of way of, here's the factory model. Here, we're going to move you through it. don't ask questions. We don't want your input. We want you to produce what we want you to produce, and we're going to track you through it early, and we're going to track you into the ways that we want you to be tracked. So there'll be people who are workers, there are people who are going to be managers, there'll be people who are whatever. And so that whole idea is a perpetuation of what the intent was. And so but now it's moved into a virtual way. Now we're in this virtual world where ostensibly, as Eduardo was saying, this is going to be a personalized instruction. It's not personalized anything. It's one size fits all. Take it or leave it. We don't really care about your ideas. We don't really care if you represent your ideas in some meaningful way for you, that we can hear you and then give you some kind of acknowledgement, recognition that you have value, that what you're doing is important and has value. So all that's just wiped out. That isn't going to happen. New York City is my other home. And so I've been talking with my friends a lot who are in New York City, who are teachers. And they're just all telling me pretty much the same thing. We're just supposed to forget what happened, and we're just supposed to jump in and do it.
Yeah.
And part of my work is around trauma and stress and everything. And I said, you can't let that happen. You just can't. These are children whose teachers might have died. People in their neighborhood have died. Places are closed that they're familiar with. Their whole world has completely been turned upside down. And it's going to take months for them to heal before any kind of what we're going to call real learning takes place. If we don't address that as the first course of action for these children, just it doesn't matter if they have a Zoom or no Zoom or whatever, because it's not going to have an impact on them, because their internalized trauma and stress is so high that they can't pay attention to other things, nor can their families, nor can the community that they live in, which has just been decimated by this in many instances. And I've been talking with people who work with preschool age children and elementary school children and all of it. And they feel personally that they don't have sometimes their own internalized, strength to go on and do it. And because there hasn't been really a supportive way of helping teachers and frontline people anyway. I mean, just basically, just generally speaking, just do your job. Don't ask questions. Just, you signed up, just do it. And all of that disrespect and all of that is a kind of a cumulative experience for people. And so the other part for me is that's the thing that really needs to be addressed before we jump into curriculum again, is can we talk about what's happening with you? Is there a way that I can reach you in order for you to tell me in a safe way what you're experiencing? Now, I'm not suggesting that teachers have to take all this on, obviously, but there needs to be people who are somewhat available. And I know this is problematic because I've read the newspapers and I know what they're trying to do with money. So I understand that. I mean, I have another whole other thought about who should be paying for this, but I don't want this to be public and I don't care actually, but resources definitely need to be reallocated so we can have the kinds of resources available for children who are really at risk in so many different ways, and communities who are at risk, communities who are under assault, essentially. That's, to me, that's one of the primary things that need to be addressed. Just as an aside, I'm going to go into a bit of a tangent, but I've been doing this very comprehensive look at developing children, and I was showing their materials in my class, and it was just laden with all of these, you just have to have grit, you just have to push through this, and we can train, I love the word train, young children to become more proficient at being on task and being cooperative and being a good friend and all that kind of stuff, which is just And I'm watching, you know, all these people from all over the country talking about it. And the last person who comes on, and she's saying, and you know what, after all this happens, we're just going to have a really wonderfully productive workforce who is adjusted and can work well with others, have a successful marriage. I mean, she went on and on and on and on. I'm like, and if you can't do it early, preschool age, your life trajectory is going to look really grim. And I thought, this is just so horrifying, you know, and that's what they're selling people, you know, and they have millions of dollars to sell it to, Andy. They're just like, they're well-funded. They have media, they have a website, they have, and people talking who have, you know, who are experts in any of these fields, but the messaging is very, very similar. And so it's hitting this, you know, it's hitting us from a very young age that, you know, and we know, because I've been working with teachers, young children who are trying to implement some of these curriculum models. And it's always the children of color who never quite seem to reach the benchmark of which they're supposed to reach. So they never get acknowledged in some tangible way in the classroom. And so, you know, these things, you know, snowball as I think it layers onto the existing situation that we're in, and it just becomes this triple, you know, issue for these children and their families. But it's always, I'm always happy when I'll ask the students, so tell me what you thought about that. And one student will say, yeah, they're trying to get workers, you know, to be compliant. I was like, thank you. It's like, you got it. That's the message.
Right. A+.
Yeah. Yeah, A+, exactly. Yeah.
Emily Auster, she's an economist as well as a parent, and she was on NPR right after our conversation with you and I, Tracy and Stephen. I was listening to her, and she was saying something around the need to hold the space or the hold a conversation about how to have conversations about transitioning, reopening schools, or how to at least come up with ideas that are best suited for different communities, because no one wants to sound controversial and be responsible for someone's death. No one wants to be blamed for, you know, what we did, and she's not necessarily wanting what a lot of the conservative sides want, which is just like, oh, we just have to carry on like nothing. But she's trying to allow the space for conversations to be had about it, because not everyone is safe at home, you know, not everyone has access to learning pods, or not everyone has, you know, there's a lot of disparities, and there isn't, she was saying, a right choice about how to do things, and to sort of get out of that framework of mind. I was wondering, maybe we can just start off there. Tracy, you worked with trauma, so have you, Stephen, and maybe both of you can share what you think about this whole, the signs out there that are saying, stay home, stay safe. I understand what they're trying to say, but it also seems as if it's silencing or just erasing also the experiences of some that are going through this confinement, where it isn't safe to be home.
Yeah. You know, I was reading today that RAIN, which is a national network for, I think it's for incest survivors, most of their calls now are from minors, and that wasn't true before. So we've seen a huge uptick in folks asking for support for sexual abuse experiences. And that's just the people who are calling. There must be so many people who aren't calling. And so because this raises stress levels, any home or family that's already trying to work with some dynamics of abuse, whether it's sexual abuse or physical abuse or domestic violence, it's most likely for most people, it's rising. Because when you're in a small place together or a large place together, it doesn't really matter the size, it's like a pressure cooker when you're stuck inside together, right? And of course, We know that kids who are experiencing abuse at home and a lack of safety and traumatic experiences at home use school as a respite. Extracurricular activities can be a respite. And, going to the park with your friends, Stephen was mentioning friends. So those are really important experiences for kids to have, and they can't, it's basically limiting, severely limiting their coping skills, because they don't have, they need an outlet and they need support. So for me, and I don't want to put more on teachers because teachers carry so much. And I also think as teachers, what would it look like if I was the person in my class for my students to be a respite person? And I've had students talk to me about violence in their homes the last few months that has, they've experienced an uptick. And I will say in my experience, I mean, I'm not trying to like get anyone to leave or, I don't have an agenda for someone. My agenda is to be able to open space so people can talk to me if they want to. And in my experience, because I get a lot of pushback about this as an instructor, when I say, well, teachers need to be counselors too. This is my opinion. Teachers need to be counselors in the sense that we're ready to listen, reflect back, and we let students know we're here for you if you need to talk. Not that many students will take me up on that offer, but some students will. And I had a student years ago who came and talked to me every week, and she didn't talk to me about anything in particular. Until she started talking about her coming out process. And then she started talking about her coming out process. And I thought, I don't know why she's coming to my office hours. And I suggested she go talk to someone else as well. But I felt strongly that I shouldn't just cut off the conversation. And she told me a year later that she was suicidal the whole time she was coming to talk to me. So I just feel like, and she didn't mention that. I really had no idea. I mean, I knew she was going through things, but I had no idea it was that extreme. That was one student in all these years. Like, I've had lots of students tell me about traumatic experiences, but most of the time people just need to be heard and then they can deal with it themselves. You can give them resources, and a lot of it is just knowing someone's there. So how can we as teachers and educators let children know we're there for them and let students of all ages, children, adolescents, young adults, older adults, I mean, some of my students are older than me. How do we let them know that we're there for them? And we can't change, and except that we can't change. If I go in trying to make sure that someone's going to be safe and get out of an unsafe situation, that's not going to be helpful. Do I want to find resources and provide them and send resources out? I send resources out to my students all the time. Yes, I want to do that. But being clear about what my role is and what opportunity I have to build that relationship with students so that they feel a sense of support. I think that that's a powerful thing teachers can do. And I don't think I have to be a therapist to do that. And I was a domestic violence counselor. I got lots of training, and people will tell me, I shouldn't be allowing students to talk to me about that kind of thing. And they used to tell me children when I worked with children because I wasn't a therapist. And I was like, no, if someone tells me that they are experiencing a trauma or they have experience, I'm not going to say, well, I'm not qualified to talk to you about that. Why don't you go talk to a therapist? For a number of reasons that we don't have to go into. But the biggest reason is like, that's the gift to me right now. And that's my opportunity to be part of this person's healing process and just be their witness. So I guess this is something that we really need to figure out how to address. And that's the piece that I think is in my locus of control as a teacher with my students, that I can offer resources and I can offer space and I can acknowledge and I can talk about it. I can talk about the fact that, there are some homes that aren't safe, even though we see these signs, and those homes are being made invisible by those signs. They're being dismissed, like you said, Eduardo. So, and a lot of people are talking about how just dealing with the pandemic in itself could become an ACE, an adverse childhood experience. And we know that there are about 13 or 14 adverse childhood experiences. And the more we have, the more likely we are to have certain health problems. And so, all the inequities in our society around poverty, around race, around gender, are going to be contributing factors. And so we want to be as proactive as we can in helping children get the support they need now not later. So it behooves us all as parents, as educators, as aunts and uncles to figure out what we can do to help people cope and get through this temporary new normal that it has. I mean, I don't know if it's, I get scared that it's not temporary. I'll be honest, but it needs to
be. Eduardo, we had a bit of this conversation the other day, but I want to kind of go back to it and maybe add something to it, which is to say that when I was talking with my friend in the East Bay who's running the program for primary Latino families, we talked about what kinds of things they're trying to put together as support for families who are not necessarily going to seek out other kinds of resources if there's things happening in the home that are dangerous or whatever. And so they've been doing town halls with the parents and breaking them into smaller groups of parents who feel comfortable together. And they in turn form their own kind of supportive network, which is to say, I'm going to lose it. Can you help me? You know, can you take my child for a walk or whatever? So I know this is very personal for people in that not everyone's going to feel comfortable with someone who they don't know in their family necessarily, but if they're by themselves and they don't have family members and things are really unraveling quickly, then having some kind of resource available to them is, I think, critical in certain points. So we talked about that just actually last night, and my friend was saying, you know, we really don't know what's happening because a lot of this is a new experience in terms of how families are feeling. But we already know that there's numerous things happening around immigration and all of those things are being layered upon this with this pandemic. And so that of in itself, that experience that families are feeling, the amount of stress, anxiety that's going on, is increasing so significantly that there has to be some kind of release, you know? So my friend was saying, I really am conflicted as to, you know, this whole idea of, you know, four or five parents getting together and doing something together. And I said, well, I think that's a choice for them. I think you can make it an opportunity for them to get connected with each other. But, it, you know, again, in the absence of anything else available, then but they can try it. They maybe will access it. So, and she said, we're doing like these virtual meetings with, they have a therapist who comes and meets virtually with the parents. And she said that the parents are feeling supported by that. And so I think, well, you're making an effort to create something in this particular environment right now that is going to be potentially helpful for any number of families, you know, who do not have the kind of resources that they are not going to pick up the phone and do some kind of whatever therapy online or something. So I think that, again, we're in the situation where people's thinking is really, really going to be critical. And so I just want to add something to that whole idea, which is we know that the neurological truth is the more stress and anxiety that we're under, the less we can actually access the higher functions of our brain. We're usually in our survival brain. So we go back and forth between our emotional brain, dealing with our strong emotions, and then dealing with survival. And survival brain thinking is highly ritualistic. So when people get stuck into an idea that's not even effective because of the level of stress and anxiety they have, they're going to stay there. So it's as we spoke about Nina before, Nina's analogy would be as someone who's not in the crisis directly, we need to lend our prefrontal cortex to them and help them with the situation that they're trying to deal with at hand. and having relationships with people that have been developed are going to be incredibly important and helpful. But at this particular moment in time, because we're really in a crisis, I think that people are going to need and will seek out some kind of connection with other people that will help them. I think we cannot ignore all of that because we're educators, so people are thinking about children's learning. But the truth of the matter is you can't talk about any of that learning unless they're feeling emotionally secure and safe. So take that off. If that's not happening, nothing's happening anyway. So the idea of, I think we're going to be talking about curriculum and ideas and things, that's going to be another part of it that's going to be really important for people to consider in all that.
I was just going to say, I think that there is an incredible amount of entrepreneurship and innovation within working class communities, and that as institutions of learning, we can offer some supports. I really like the idea of offering people a facilitated environment to help facilitate building relationships, and I guess also just building on relationships that are already there, because people already have these relational networks. And people are, there's so much mutual aid happening in working class communities, and at just asking those questions and trying to be a facilitator of, to be building on the entrepreneurship and innovation that already exists so that people can depend on each other in additional ways and think about, you know, get out of our fear brain, which is our brainstem, thinking like, and is it, would it be an appropriate risk for me to take to call my neighbor and ask them to take my child for a walk? Because we know that the risk is lower outside. We know that if you wear a mask, the risk is low. We know, you know, so for me, that's part of the harm reduction. I mean, I think it's harm reduction in terms of the technology impact on children's learning and children's development. And I think there's also harm reduction in terms of how we deal with the pandemic and COVID, because everybody has a different, I mean, different people have different opinions about how dangerous it is, what, you know, what it does. We know that, I mean, you know, I believe that we know that if we wear masks, we protect ourselves, but we protect others. So I do think that there could be room for a conversation of that, of what would be a way to take a low risk that has a high impact on our mental health. Mm-hmm. And development. So, and those are conversations that I think we need to have more often.
Yeah, I think we need to have them quickly.
Yeah.
Well, our school district said they were having them, but they didn't. They had conversations at parents, and we were even teachers. Our union was involved, but it wasn't up for discussion about really what the nature of this. How do we describe safety? I really truly believe that we are far more unsafe in going forward in the way we're going forward on the scope of all things, where we're basically asking students maybe every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday to spend 3 hours having an absolutely false experience, and then maybe 4 hours the next day, whatever.
And still grading them, no?
I just mean literally, you will be asked to stare in front of a screen for 4 hours, for 3 hours, daily. You're going to do that every day. And all of that is happening in the context of their classroom is a place that might have a virus in it or not, but definitely is being impacted by an economic crisis, which is worse than anything we've since. And so we can only imagine the kinds of social pressures that families are experiencing. These are all places of, that's immensely dangerous. And yes, the reason it's important, the reason I can say that it's important for a student to be, like, when students come to school, it's the passing period. When they recover, it's that's 30 minutes that you were talking about, Stephen. That's, you know, it's that passing period when they recover, where they meet with their friends and do the sorts of things. And they get to select the adult that they feel safe to. It's not selected for them. They select the adult. They pick you, Tracy. That student picked you that felt safe. And that's what's happened with me. Like, I don't pick who comes to me. They pick me, right. You know, and students need that. And they're not going to have any of that. All that is now being stripped away. And so I think, and I want to say something as a teacher, that actually, it was that experience of working with students through that frustration, through that times when I would get frustrated or they would come to me and I didn't know what to do. That's the only part of education I think is even worth a damn. Mm-hmm. Everything else is ridiculous. Everything else is me sorting them out for a capitalist, giving them a grade, blah, blah, blah. But that was the only piece that was human, that was actually that I believed in, and they've taken it out. That's why me and AJ, my partner, you know, my other colleague, we're like, I think I'm going to hate my job this year because they've taken the last piece of it that has any meaning to me.
So let me ask you, is there any way to, because this is going back to the beginning of like, we're in this gray area. What can we do in this opportunity? We are acting within certain constraints within distance learning. So are there things, I mean, there are some things we can do, but is there any way to recreate that passing period with your colleagues at Mission High School? Is there any way? So for me, what we did is I facilitated a small group with my son on Zoom and three or four of his friends, and they built in three dimensions things with recycled materials, with cardboard and tape, basically, marble runs and a marble maze and a few other projects. So that they were, at least the thing was on and they were socializing, and the rule was you don't get to play with the screen because otherwise they'll play with the screen a lot. And then they're using real three-dimensional activities. And then after that was over, that hour and a half, some of them would continue that project. He does that with his cousins on art, you know, because we can't go visit them. So I feel like, what is the opportunity? Can we give students, what I'm trying to do is find ways to give students assignments that will deepen their connections in the real world. So asking, they have interviews of their parents or their grandparents or their kids or their other family members about topics related to our class. They had in the spring, and I think I'm going to do it again in the fall, but I had a self-care project that was for some optional, and it was actually optional for everyone because I don't think you should force that on anybody, but it was an alternate to their final assessment, and probably 90% of my students did that, and they had to choose a research-based practice that they were going to commit to for 8 weeks and then talk about it a few times about how it was impacting them. And it was all about sharing, how are you doing, what's going on, here, share a resource, because they had all these resources, and then we would check in about the self-care. So I feel like within the constraints, my question is, what can we do to recreate something that's meaningful? Because I did create some meaningful relationships, even in my 5-week classes and online, which I don't like teaching online, I'll be honest. I had already signed up to teach an online hybrid class because I thought, oh, it's something new. I should try it. Let me see. Maybe it'll be good, you know. And it's just not the same. But anyway, I'm doing it. And I know I have to do it with everything. So I guess that's my question for you. Can you recreate the passing period in any way? Can you recreate any kind of a situation where students would have that choice? Because choice is key. Choice is key for a young child's brain and as a toddler. And it's key for in all these, throughout our lifespan, we need to have choices so that our brains.
Semantic choice, not A, B, C, D.
Right. No, yeah, not multiple choices in that way. Real choices and embodied, contextualized choices so that I can decide, oh, I really want to talk to Andy about that. Or I really want to talk to Eduardo about this issue. And having those relationships, is that possible? I wanted to touch on that a little bit because I feel like it's really important to share some ideas. And
Yeah, we talked about that before, which is, so I sent you both an article and I didn't send it to Andy. I didn't send it out to everyone, which was the Bruce Perry article, which I don't know if you had a chance to see.
I didn't.
But it's a really important article because it delineates and the different kinds of methods, I don't like that word, different ways of connecting with children, young people around their stress. And so for me, that's going to be the way that we're going to have to take control of the narrative and say, you know, 80, I don't know, one of the teens was like, he has to do 8 hours of Zoom, I think, or something like that. And then he had another, he basically was doing twice as much time doing academics between that and the Zoom and also the other thing. So he had no downtime whatsoever. But because they're teens, they still need to talk to their friends. So they were up till 2 or 3 in the morning doing their Snapchat because they still needed to be connected with their friends because they were completely, they were not available in the way that you mentioned, Annie, passing in the hall. They didn't have any of those rituals that they all use to diffuse themselves and get reconnected with other people, which they need, you know, really need, particularly as they get older and all those developmental stuff are going on with them and they're making all these, you know, developmental transitions and life transitions and all that. So I am stuck now. I think I'm blowing it. I'm old, so I'm blowing a gasket. It's like,
you're not old.
Yes, I am.
Zoom's got you. another body snatched by Zoom.
Really? Yeah. This is my only 4th Zoom experience, I want you to know. I just started doing FaceTime 2 months ago because I miss my friends so much. I said, maybe we should do FaceTime. They're like, you want to do FaceTime? Like, yeah, but I just need to see you. Yeah. On a ridiculous phone, I'll be happy to just see your face. I'm going to stop because I have like 19 different things I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I have a lot of different directions. So I think if we could get clear on like exactly which themes we want to go into and maybe discuss more what you're looking for in terms of temporary versus new normal. I mean, I just think we can't let it be. I think we have to make sure it's temporary. I don't know if it's, who knows? We don't know, right? But I'm not co-signing for this long term. I don't even co-sign for it right now. I mean, I'm going to work with it, so I guess in a way I'm co-signing.
Well, I do hope we can kind of return to a part two in a few weeks or something like that. We'll be in school and we'll kind of be able to report what's actually taking place, what the schedules are. And I'd love to be able to ask you, what do you think of this bell schedule? You know, what do you, you know, but as well as some of these things. So,
And I think that by then, maybe, however, I don't know when we'll do part two, but if we do part two later in a semester, we'll have we'll have studies coming out where Stephen and Tracy can share with us of an update of like, what has this been doing? I mean, we have some idea from the spring, right? But really seeing what it looks like, they'll be able to share with us.
We know a lot of people who are working in the field right now. So, you know, we can check in with them and just say, you know, what's happening with you.
Good idea. And I mean, there's things like we didn't share the parent survey. I mean, one of the things parents asked for across different cultural groups was more individualized attention, which is what we came to ourselves, right? It's like, this big group thing is problematic. So, and it could be counterproductive in my opinion. I do think it's counterproductive. And then there are things that I didn't talk about. Like, for example, I know we have to go. There's this book that I would recommend. It's called Screen Schooled. And it's pre-COVID, but it really breaks down. It's two pretty like pro-tech people talking about why they're anti-tech in schools.
Wow.
And the other book is that's related to adolescence is called iGen. And it's by Jean Twenge. And she looks at survey data from many different, from generations. Like, I think it's around 16,000 young people. And really looking at the correlation between the rise in social media use and the corresponding rise in depression, suicide, and anxiety.
That's right.
So it's a helpful book. I sent you the name of that book.
So maybe then we could reconvene for more. I think if we can do part two, that's all right.
Yeah, sure.
If this is a good space for us to just end here, if that's all right with everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you have any links, please share with us so that we can put in the episode show notes, and then people who request more info, they can always click on it. All right.
Tracy and Stephen, please, thank you very much for coming here and talking about this. I think it's really important. So
me too.
I definitely really appreciate hearing this. And I think those people who listen to this, I think are going to get a lot out of it.
Thank you.
I I really do appreciate it. I just want to make sure that when I do the outro, the music that my nephew is playing in the background is not on. So if you can just hold.
Kahanu, Kahanu, Kahanu. ¿Puedes apagar esa el piano, por favor, por el momento? Ya casi termino, dame 5 minutos. Ahorita, bebé.
Okay, sorry. I'm so sorry.
That's going to stay in the episode.
Okay, Andy, we'll talk about that later. I don't know if I like all your bloopers.
That would be nice, episode, Eduardo. That would be nice. People get to hear like a parent setting a limit in a, an uncle setting a limit in a loving, clear way.
Okay. Let's outro. Yes, thank you. Yes, poor Anam. He's discussing with Kahanu, like, why does he have to turn off the piano? That does it for this week's episode. Thank you, Tracy and Stephen, for joining us today. What's Left is a weekly political podcast / channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webno.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast / channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you have heard, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our 6 platforms on Spotify, iTunes Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-host Andy Lipson. And saludos, Kenny Cepeda. Hopefully you're listening. A big thank you to Tracy and Steven. Tracy Burton, Steven Santos Rico, thank you very much for being with us. We'll see you all next time. Ciao.
Ciao.